My name is David Wee. I'm an English professor at St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota. And my wife, Karen, is over here in the black sweater. And she and I just arrived here at Holden Saturday. We've never been here before. So if some of you are new to this place, we're only a few days ahead of you on it, but already we're having a good time. We're going to be here for 4 months, and I'm going to be talking about literature and education and maybe a few other things I'm interested in, like distance running. If you may have seen me running around in my underwear around here, and glad that there are a few other people who like to do it too. What I decided to do this afternoon was inspired by the very first Vespers meditation that we heard last Saturday by Leo Bustin, who is also here in the faculty for a few weeks. If you haven't heard him yet, I hope that you do go to some of his sessions because it's lots of fun. But at his opening Vespers opening meditation for us last Saturday, he used two texts which he said had never been used in the Lutheran Church before, and I'm sure he was right. He read two verses from Scripture which consisted simply of the naming of names, the listing of names of several people. And then he used that as a basis for a talk on being different. And one of his main points was that God cares about individuals. That God didn't talk about people in a collective sense, but named names, as had been done in these scriptural passages he had read. And he wanted to make the point that God loves all the weirdos in the world. And he read a poem as part of his meditation about the importance of being different from other people in this kind of homogenized society in which we live. And of course, if God didn't love weird people, why, Leo would be in trouble, and so would a lot of us. And that was an important point that that he wanted to make. So I decided, it started me thinking about some poems that I know about loving people who are different, or strange, or a little weird, or appreciating things that are not ordinary. And I thought that today it would be good to have us read together and talk about a few poems. And in a few minutes, I'll pass these around so you can read them with me. But I also want to use some of these sessions to talk about and to help people learn to read poetry better and to enjoy it more. Some people have vastly different responses to poetry from others of us. Some of us don't understand poetry. Some of us love it. Some of us hate it. Some of us consider it to be a kind of frivolous activity to read poems and think that poetry has nothing whatsoever to do with the day-to-day life that we lead. But it's very strange that most of us adults can read, and if a poem is written in English and that's our native language, why is it that two of us can read the same poem and yet have vastly different experiences with it? Or perhaps the 30 of us or so here would read it and have 30 different experiences, and yet we're reading the same thing. Well, part of the reason for that is that reading poetry and responding to it is a creative experience. We bring ourselves to a poem, and each of us is a different person. And reading poetry is not like reading the newspaper. One problem is that many people read poetry like they read the newspaper. And we can talk a little bit about the sort of things one has to do, the kind of shifting of gears that's necessary in reading a poem and having a fuller response to it. Some of us are fairly insensitive to what's going on in a poem, and we need to develop the ability to have that fuller response. And one of the ways of developing that ability is to do what my students call tearing a poem apart. Often students object to the activity that they call tearing a poem apart, and they say that it ruins the poem for them to talk about it in the classroom, especially in such a way that the poem no longer exists as a nice artistic piece, but it's been ripped to shreds and discussed line by line and in categories that seem to ruin it. But my contention as a teacher of poetry is that the whole reason for doing that, for tearing poems apart, is so that every time we come to that poem again or to any other poems, we might have a better experience with reading it and simply respond to it in a fuller way and therefore make reading poetry worthwhile. Now, an analogy that I think of in this situation, and I'll ask you to imagine this. Imagine that a professional football coach, I think of Bud Grant of the Minnesota Vikings because that's where I'm from. Imagine a professional football coach and say an 80-year-old grandmother from the old country are sitting in a living room together watching the Super Bowl on television. Both have 20/20 vision. There they are watching the whole Super Bowl game. And try to imagine the different kind of experience the two of them are having. Now imagine that the football coach is very excited that he sees certain plays occur and is stimulated and pleased and cheers and so forth. Whereas the grandmother might look at what was going on the screen and think that it's just a bunch of foolishly dressed and horribly ugly big men knocking into each other and kicking a strange-shaped ball around, and it doesn't make any sense at all. And I maintain that it would really be a waste of time for that person to watch the Super Bowl game. She's not having any fun. She's not getting excited about what's happening. But the football coach watching the very same data, the very same visual material, notices that on a running play, the left guard pulls out, runs interference, and takes out the left linebacker, and therefore the first down occurs. The grandmother didn't see that, of course. She just saw a bunch of people knocking into each other. Or the football coach notices the head fake that the flanker back puts on the opposing cornerback, and therefore catches a pass that leads to a touchdown. And the other person watching that saw the same stuff, but in a sense didn't see what happened and therefore doesn't get excited about it. Well, I maintain that the football coach ought to watch the Super Bowl game because he's perceiving what happens. He knows the craft and the art and the skill of playing football so that he notices all the little things that are happening that makes a play work or makes a play not work. Whereas the other person who doesn't know what's possible and what isn't, who doesn't understand the craft and the skill or the art of playing football, doesn't understand, doesn't appreciate, doesn't get excited, and would be better off in the kitchen making lefse, perhaps. Now, I think that the same thing holds for poetry, that we can both, all of us together, can read the same words on a page. Some of us get excited and a chill runs up our spine, and we want to run over to somebody and share it and say, you've got to read this poem. It's exciting, it's meaningful, it's important. The other of us takes the poem and reads it and says, so what? You know, it doesn't mean a thing. It leaves me cold as a fish. And I think that we want to have the fullest kind of human experience that we can have with whatever we're doing, whether it be watching football or reading poetry. Therefore, if it bothers you to tear poems apart, talk about them, maybe in the way that we may talk about a few poems today. I hope that the end result, the long-range result, can be that any time that you read poetry, you'll begin to notice more what's happening in the poem, rather than just reading the words and shrugging your shoulders, and having a kind of experience that's worthwhile. Because I believe, as I'm going to say in a talk on Saturday, or Friday, I think, that poetry and other kinds of literature are extremely important in teaching us to be wise and to be better human beings. And yet, we have to work hard in order for that to happen. A couple of other things about reading poetry. One thing is that we should read poems aloud as often as we can. Often when I'm teaching freshman students in college, I'll ask them to read a poem, which I love, aloud in class. And it's just horrifying, because they read it, again, as if they're reading the newspaper or a grocery list or something, with absolutely no sense of what the writer is trying to say and do. There's a lot of music in poetry. One of the things that distinguishes poetry from other ways of putting words together is that poetry is done in such a way that the sounds and the rhythms, the spaces between the sounds, are important and intentional. And some poems need to be shouted, and others to be whispered, and others to be sung. And if we read them all as if we were reading something dull or a textbook, we're misusing the thing as a work of art. So we'll read some poems aloud today, and I urge you, anytime you read a poem, read it aloud and try to give to the words of the poem the sound, the rhythms that the poem is demanding of us. Secondly, we need to be alert to various meanings of language as well as to the sounds. One thing a poet does is to try to use language in special ways, and often use words that function in more than one way. And we need to be alert and sensitive to the fact that a certain word may have several meanings, and it's being used in all of those meanings at once, or in just one and not the other of those meanings, and always be alert to that. A third way to appreciate literature is to discuss it with others, like we'll do this afternoon. I've discovered that even though I will sometimes teach the same poem or the same story year after year to groups of students, every year the students are different. And you are a group of people with whom I've never discussed these poems, and the experience will be different. And you and I will learn a few things from each other, and learn that each of us has a slightly different kind of creative response to the same work of art. And finally, I urge us all to take poetry and other kinds of literature seriously. I think if we remind ourselves once in a while, when we read a poem or a story, that sometime, somewhere in history, some person has felt so strongly about an idea or a vision of life or a perception of what life should be, could be like, that they have devoted a lifetime or a great period of time to trying to create a work of art. A poem is a work of art as much as a painting is. To create a work of art that will speak to human beings forever. That's what every artist hopes, is that their work will be eternal. The reason that we read the plays of Shakespeare and go to see the plays of Shakespeare 400 years after he wrote them is that those plays have eternal messages that are significant to all human beings. And that most of the good literature that we read, novels, stories, plays, poems, that we read year after year and century after century, we're reading them because they're addressed to you and me. They're talking about us, not about some other kinds of creatures or people in another century. Shakespeare is speaking to you and me, not just to his contemporaries in the 16th and 17th century. And that means that we really ought to take seriously the kind of attempt that a writer is making in writing a poem. All right, now to the poems that I was urged to think about during Leo's meditation. The first one I haven't been able to find. I didn't bring along all my books, and I've scoured the library and asked other people for help, and I haven't found it yet, so I'll just tell you a few things about it, and maybe someday you'll have the chance to look it up. It's a poem called Love Poem, and it's by a poet named John Frederick Nims, N-I-M-S. He's not a famous poet. He's an American poet. I think he's still living. But it's my favorite love poem. And it's my favorite because it is a profound expression of love for an odd person. That is, most love poems that we know are praising the beauty or the skills or the various virtues of another human being. And this poem talks mostly about the clumsiness and the awkwardness of the woman who the speaker in the poem loves. It begins, "My clumsiest dear." And the next line says, "Whose hands shipwreck vases." She's so clumsy that she's always knocking over vases, and he uses the term shipwreck as the verb to describe what she does to porcelain and vases and so forth. The poet talks about, and the speaker talks about, the way in which this woman lunges across traffic. Cars are always screeching to a halt when she leaps out into traffic. She's not graceful at all. And there are images of how she's always smearing lipstick on things or spilling bourbon on the picnic blanket, and so forth. And yet the poet ends up, after a poem of 10 or 12 lines filled with these images of clumsiness, pointing out that the one place that the loved one is graceful is with ill at ease people. She is graceful in responding to human beings who are out of place, who have a need. She's good at comforting others, and drunks who might stagger to the door. That's the sort of person whom this person, the loved one, the woman, is graceful with. And he ends the poem, I'm trying to remember the lines, I think they go this way, the last two lines. "If those hands," these are those same hands that shipwrecked faces, "if those hands should fall still, all the toys of the world would break." In other words, the speaker says, you know, all the things that give me pleasure and joy are bound up in you, my clumsiest dear. And if your hands should fall still, if you should ever die, you know, all that's meaningful to me would be broken. And I find this a profound and exciting poem, and a funny poem at the same time, because the images are so unusual. We laugh at the picture of the loved one that the poet creates, and yet points out that not only in spite of, but partly because of that characteristic, that clumsiness, that person is all the more precious. And if that clumsiness were gone from the speaker's life, his life would be desperately lessened. Well, that's a kind of summary of it, and hope someday you can find it and read it exactly as it is. It's a short poem, and it's simply called Love Poem. Now I'm going to give you three other poems, which I've had the print shop reproduce. We may not have quite enough for everyone here, so you may need to do a little sharing. As soon as you've all got it, I'm going to read aloud the first one in the upper left, which is a poem by E.E. Cummings. I'm sure many of you have read poems by Cummings. He writes unorthodox poems. he must have been a highly unusual person, and all of his poems are unusual. And I'll ask you to just follow along with me as I read it aloud. And then I'm going to ask you just to respond to it a little bit, to tell me what comes to mind, or any feelings or responses that you have, and then we'll talk about it in a little more detail. Who hasn't got a copy now? Is someone close enough to share with you? Anyone who needs to share with someone? This one is, Cummings didn't title many of his poems. They usually go by the title. The title is usually the first line. Anyone lived in a pretty how town, with up so floating many bells down, spring, summer, autumn, winter, he sang his didn't, he danced his did. Women and men, both little and small, cared for anyone not at all. They sowed their isn't, they reaped their same, sun, moon, stars, rain. Children guessed, but only a few, and down they forgot as up they grew. Autumn, winter, spring, summer, that no one loved him more by more. When by now and tree by leaf, she laughed his joy, she cried his grief. Bird by snow and stir by still, anyone's any was all to her. Someone's married their everyone's, laughed their cryings and did their dance. Sleep, wake, hope, and then they said their nevers, they slept their dream. Stars, rain, sun, moon, and only the snow can begin to explain how children are apt to forget to remember with up so floating many bells down. One day anyone died, I guess, and no one stooped to kiss his face. Busy folk buried them side by side, little by little and was by was, all by all and deep by deep, and more by more they dream their sleep. No one and anyone, earth by April, wish by spirit, and if by yes. Women and men, both dong and ding, summer, autumn, winter, spring, reaped their sowing and went their came, sun, moon, stars, rain. Well, now, what sort of response do you have to that poem? Do you have any top of the head feelings about it?
I wonder what it's all about.
Right. You wonder what it's all about.
He's telling it like it is.
Pardon?
He's telling it like it is.
Okay.
Not something made of a mistake, typographical.
Yeah. It looks like a typographical mistake. Okay.
You feel that life goes on. Someone dies and life just goes
on. Without any significant change.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
These are experiences everyone has. The children have them.
Okay.
They're always skipping up down the hill, and I haven't skipped for years. So I thought, well, if I was up here another week, I'd be skipping too.
I'm good. Okay. Well, it is a poem, isn't it, that makes you wonder right off the bat, and it doesn't make any sense at all. The words are thrown together in odd ways, aren't they? There are lots of strange collections of words and phrases in here. And it has a kind of nonsense rhythm to it, too, doesn't it? A kind of childlike...
babbling.
Yeah, like there's a babbling in it, it seems like. And it's got the kind of rocking horse rhythm of skipping or playing and ups and downs and ins and outs. So it almost sounds like, say, a nursery rhyme or some kind of playful thing. Yet I believe the poem is a very serious poem, and it has some very explicit things to say to us. So now I'll talk about it a little bit, and you interrupt and chime in, and I'll try to restrain myself from talking too much because I think that you'll notice some things that I perhaps haven't ever noticed in the poem. One thing that we need to do when we look at poems is to notice how they're shaped. That is, poems are quite often organized in very specific ways. They have patterns in them. Just like sometimes paintings have patterns and repeated shapes and colors and spaces and so forth. Did you notice any pattern to this? Or anything? Maybe we should start with a more obvious thing. What about matters like punctuation and capitalization? Well, it's not quite that there's none. Okay. There are two capital letters in the whole poem. Where are they?
Women in both places.
Okay, women in both places. One good thing about Cummings, he knew what to capitalize. Yeah. Okay, capitalized the word women at the start of the second stanza and the last stanza. Where is the punctuation? Okay, there's some parentheses scattered throughout. And there are periods. Where are the periods? Okay. After yes in the next to the last stanza. And after did in the first stanza. Okay. And those come right before the capital letters. You know, he's capitalizing the start of the what comes right after the period. Now, what we ought to try to figure out eventually is why did he put the periods and the capital letters, that is the starts and the stops of the sentences at those points and not at any place else.
He didn't have a grudge against women.
Pardon?
He didn't have a grudge against
no,
women.
No, that's right. He does have a grudge, though, in the poem. Yes?
I wouldn't like to say a grudge, but it seems to me it starts out typical USA vicinity. It originates in a town.
Okay.
And then he begins with the people involved, and I
mm-hmm.
One figure is in there, okay, and men. And to me, I see a suburban type atmosphere struggling, you know, because of he's boxed everybody into a category,
mm-hmm.
all are. And then the coming of grief, you know, where you begin with the half time the children are growing, and then comes the marriage and where the child has grown and has become the woman
okay.
now, and then she married. So then the dance is different.
Okay.
It's always got this little dance in certain spots here.
Okay, that's a good thing to notice. Lots of dances, and you've noticed the progression. There's growth and change
yeah.
in it, isn't there?
Okay, I'm to that point.
Okay, good. Okay. See, one thing we begin to notice about this poem is that it's a kind of cyclical poem. Many poems kind of start here and go in a straight line to the end. And Cummings has made this a kind of circular poem. You notice that the second stanza is the one capitalized. The first stanza isn't capitalized. It's kind of like beginning in the middle. And then it comes to an end, and then it starts with women and men. And then it comes to another period in the next to the last stanza. Then it begins again, but it doesn't have a period at the end, as if it goes right on back to the beginning again, you see. Causes that kind of cycle that represents that growth that you mentioned. You mentioned that the stanzas, different stanzas are about different people. Who is the first stanza about? It's about anyone, isn't it?
Yeah, he's saying.
And we notice here one of the things immediately that Cummings is doing, he's using this word anyone in two different ways. He's using the word anyone as the name of one of the persons in this poem. And yet we also understand that to be one of our pronouns referring to anybody in the world.
Anonymous.
Yeah, anonymous or kind of anybody.
That's almost a name, the way
right. The word no one is another person in the poem. And sometimes, well...
See, anyone dies, a man is sick to keep his place.
Okay.
But could it be that he referred to a man because it says he?
That's right. The he in the poem does refer to the character in the poem whose name is anyone. And there's another specific person whose name is no one. And she is a woman, we discover by the other pronouns. So anyone and no one are two individuals, and yet the pronoun still functions. For instance, in the second stanza is about whom? It's about women and men, isn't it? Okay. And notice that it says, women and men, both little and small, cared for anyone, not at all. Now here the word anyone means two things at the same time. It means that those women and men didn't care for anybody. They didn't care for people. And it also means that they didn't care for that individual person named anyone. So here, Cummings is kind of punning here, using the words two ways at the same time. Okay, the first stanza... Oh, excuse me. That's right, there's not very much caring on their part, as we'll notice when we look at this. Okay, the first stanza is about anyone. The second one is about women and men. The third stanza is about children. He gives us the subject of this of each stanza right in the first words of each stanza. Okay, then the fourth stanza is about... Well, the people it's about, though. It's about anyone and no one again. Here, anyone is joined by no one, but it's back to anyone. And the next stanza is about the someones, and those are the women and men, aren't they? The other people.
And
that's right. And then the sixth stanza is about
children.
Notice it's a repeated pattern. First three stanzas are about anyone, and the women and men, and then the children. Then he goes through that same pattern again. Anyone, this time joined by no one, and then the women and men, and then the children. Then notice that the next stanza is about anyone and no one again, as we would expect. We kind of expect that same pattern to repeat. But then the next pattern is about anyone and no one, two stanzas in a row about anyone and no one. And the last stanza is about the women and men again. What happened to the children? There's not a third stanza about them.
They grew up.
They grew up. They are the women and men now, aren't they?
Yeah.
So you see how the very organization of the stanzas, what the topic of each stanza of the poem and reinforces this idea of growth and change and the cycles of life and the generations replacing the generations without any change.
You don't even remember.
Yeah, that's right. You can't tell the difference between the women and men at the end and those at the beginning. So you see, Cummings has tried to can organize the whole thing in such a way that we see this ongoingness of human life and the cyclical patterns of the children growing up and becoming the women and men. But we have in the poem the contrast between anyone and no one and everyone else. Now, what is it that we notice about anyone and no one? How do they differ from the someones and the women and men?
They cared for each other.
They cared for each other. And how do you know that? Where do you read that?
Well, she laughed his joy and she cried his grief.
Okay.
And the last line of that same stanza, anyone's any was all to her.
That's right.
There was an emphasis there on anything of this other person or she was concerned about.
That's right. That's a good point. That's one of the key lines in the poem.
That caught my eye first.
Anything at all? Anyone's any, this is the last line of the fourth stanza, anyone's any was all to her. Anything at all about the other person meant everything to her. That's perfect sharing. And that's what love is all about. And it's in contrast to what the rest of the people in the poem, the large group of society, how they respond to each other. There's a long list there of this by this. Side by side is where it starts. They're buried. This is in the third stanza from the end. Busy folk buried them side by side, and then little by little, and was by was, all by all, deep by deep, and then you get to earth by April, and so forth. A long list of those things. What sense can we make out of all of that? Now, those are good suggestions. The interesting thing is the word by. See, what Cummings does is to take some idioms, some of our cliches, and jerk them around and put some unexpected things in there. Side by side is one that we all recognize. People are often buried side by side. But then was by was is a completely unusual way of speaking. And there are a few others. Can some of you point out these other kind of wrenched idioms where we expect one combination of words and we get a slightly different combination instead?
They slept their dreams.
Okay.
They dreamed while they slept.
Okay. They slept their dreams. Have you noticed how often, by the way, Cummings uses an inversion or uses one phrase to talk about anyone and no one, and a similar but inverted phrase to talk about the other people? This is one. They slept their dream, whereas what do anyone and no one do? They dream their sleep. A few lines later. There are a few others like that. Did any of you notice them?
What did you say?
Well, there's this contrast here at the end of the fifth stanza. The someones slept their dream. And two stanzas later we read that anyone and more one, and no one dream their sleep. Switched around, and it's changed from past tense to present tense.
The last stanza, the third line, is this one of those?
Yep.
Reap their sowing. Not yep. Proper order, but went there came. That's reversed, isn't it?
Well, even went there came, we'd never link those two. What do you do when you... Right, you come and go, but went there came is a... The words are being used not as verbs, but as... went is used as a verb, but came is being used as a noun. Right.
They're coming, in other words.
Well... Let me point out a couple others like this because I think they help us see what's happening in those kind of changes. Notice in the very first stanza, the fourth line, when we're reading about anyone, we read that he sang his didn't and he danced his did. Now did and didn't are verbs, but here they're being used as nouns. Now, what can it mean to that he sang his didn't and he danced his did? The only thing I'm not quite sure about is the word boasting. What does singing and dancing suggest?
Joy
and celebration and happiness. For both the things that the dids and the didn'ts, that is, both success and failure are celebrated by this person.
He learned by.
That's right. He can be happy and take satisfaction and celebration from the good things and the bad things, the accomplishments and the failures. That's an important thing about anyone, and that differentiates him from the other people. What do they do? That's right. And notice the place where he draws the contrast here is in the fifth stanza. They laughed their cryings and did their dance. What do we mean when we say somebody does their dance? It means they're just going through the motions, doesn't it? To do your dance is just going through the motions without any meaning. He dances, he danced his did. Other people just do their dance. See how he's kind of shifted the words, he's reversed them to show the contrast between most people just going through the motions in life, but anyone is a person who celebrates success and failure both. In the second stanza, notice that the women and men sowed their isn't and reaped their same. That's right. It reminded me a little of Leo's phrase that he referred to in another of his talks the other day. He said, we have a word for it, GIGO, garbage in, garbage out. And he was talking about computers. Garbage in, garbage out. If you put garbage into a computer, that's what you'll get out of one. This is another way of saying that people sowed their isn't, which is a negative, a non-being, and that's what they reap. They reap the same. Yeah. So the rest of the people are putting nothingness or very little into life, and that's what they're reaping from life. And then at the last stanza, we see again that they reaped their sowing. The very thing that earlier on, they'd reaped their isn't, and that's what they'd sowed their isn't, and that's what they'd reaped, and a generation later, they're doing the same thing. No change. They're reaping that sowing of nothing. So again, we see that the majority of society are doing very little.
Went there came then mean that they who have sowed nothing and reaped nothing, they're going out as they have come in. In other words, they went as they came.
That's right. And the other thing is that they don't seem to be making. And what does it mean? Went and came mean the opposite things, which seems that they're engaged in inappropriate actions. They should went their going instead of went their coming. See, they should, but they're doing the opposite thing of what's appropriate. I think there's another place where we can see the difference in the way in which human beings respond emotionally to each other. You look at the fourth stanza where we read about anyone and no one together. And what does she do? She laughed his joy. And cried his grief. But in the next stanza, we read about the someones. What did they do?
They laughed
their cryings. See, they anyone and no one are sharing appropriate emotions. She laughs with him over his joy and cries with him over his grief. But the other people have an inappropriate response. No, they laughed their cryings when they should have been crying with other people's grief. They've got a totally inappropriate and kind of opposite response to the needs and emotions of each other. So once again, we see that that where anyone and no one have this kind of appropriate and close personal and sensitive response to each other, the other people have a kind of inappropriate. They went their keens. They laughed their cryings. It's the wrong response. They danced their dids. Or did their dance. He's the one who danced his did. And then the little bit about the children. I've used this line from the third stanza as part of the title for the talk I'm going to give on Thursday. And down they forgot.
No one left him more by more.
That's right. That's the answer. That's right. They guessed that no one loved him more by more. The children are able to perceive the love between these two human beings, whereas the women and men, everyone else, ignore them, don't seem to understand them, don't pay much attention to them. But the children are perceptive. But one of the things that happens to us as we grow up and mature is that we lose some of that perceptiveness. In his words, we forget.
And, do you lose it?
Yes.
It isn't a matter of losing, it is a matter of being a matter of course.
That's right. That's right. That's exactly right.
You perceive it, but it is something that is like breathing.
Yeah. That's right.
You don't think of it.
Yeah. It's kind of intuition,
right,
isn't it? And yet, through growing up, there's a downward motion in the sense that we lose that. We lose that kind of intuitive and appropriate response. So coming is, it seems to me, in this poem, is using this language in a seemingly nonsensical way. But you see, one thing he does by taking the words...
He's coming and going.
He's coming and going, that's right. He forces us to scratch our heads and look at the language more closely and try to make some sense out of it. And if we pay close attention to it, we can make sense out of some of these inverted phrases and some of the contrasts and the pattern of the whole poem. And what he's saying to us is that there are people in the world who do have appropriate responses to each other. We're all, in a sense, little people, anyone and no ones. We may be seen by other people as anyone and no one, but two people can have an appropriate love and response and sharing with each other, even in a society where the someones, everyone who is everyone, the women and men, virtually ignore those individuals, ignore each other, go through the motions, grow up, marry, die, the cycle repeats itself. Nothing seems to change except when two individuals love one another, share each other's needs and emotions appropriately.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Does the order in which he expresses the seasons have anything to do with any special meaning?
I can't make any sense out of that. Maybe some of you will have an answer for that. They aren't always in the same order, and the fact that they change order, I think, is his way of showing that time passes, that we're moving from season to season.
I think in the third stanza, you're saying all the year round.
Sure. That this is happening all the time. It's a yearly thing, and then another year, another set of seasons is repeated.
This is a bit like Grand Central Station.
Yeah.
I mean, many, many, many conversations going on at the same time.
Yeah.
Bits and pieces.
That's right. It's the way it's put together.
And you have to love the guy to stop long enough to try to make sense of it.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And I think the sun, moon, stars, rain kind of thing is intended to give it a kind of cosmic sense, saying this is a universal matter. This is the way it operates universally amongst people. And yet he does it in this kind of sing-song way so that we're almost beguiled into thinking it's a nonsense poem.
How many times do you think he wrote this first time?
Oh, I'm sure he worked very hard on it. You first look at it and you think it was tossed together while he was drunk or something. but I'm sure he worked very carefully on that.
But sir, there's some lines in here. I'd like your explanation. With up so floaty, many bells down. That doesn't make a bit of sense to me, and I just wondered if you could explain it.
It's used twice.
Yep, I wish I could.
down below here, he says, how children are apt to forget to remember. With up so floaty, he's using it again, and I wondered what it means.
Well, I'm not sure that one can put an exact translation of that line, but I think he wanted to get a sense of floating bells in it, to sense this
floating
rhythm. And then he brings in, what does he call the women and men in the last stanza?
Ding and dong.
Dong and ding. It's even a little different from the usual idiom, as if we were all ding-dong people, a bunch of ding-dongs. What the people are like.
That's okay.
And a kind of monotonous sense of...
Yeah. It seems like he wants to use the opposite instead of, like we say, being to go.
That's right. He wants to kind of jar us into noticing it more than we would if...
It's like the other
one. Yeah, that's right.
I like that phrase as just a, you know, a whimsical kind of phrase that children would turn on to. They forget to remember.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the sad thing about children, but that's a description of the town. It's delightful.
Yeah.
You know what it means, but it's a delightful phrase.
Yeah.
You get visual images from that line. You know, they're concrete. I get flower images from bells in the town. Some bells ring in Spanish too.
That's right.
Dogs bark in Japanese or just in it.
Yeah, that's right. And most towns do have their bells, you know, in any culture. Yeah.
When he says they're both little and small.
Yeah.
That's
right.
I'm curious on this poem. If I had grown it, I would never have gotten it published. How far along in his life did he?
I don't know the answer to that. I really don't.
I don't know what happened with his publishing career, but almost all of Cummings' poems are askew like this. He'll, even on a page, they'll come running down the page like this. And,
did you start off talking about weird people?
It's really... No. I think
weirdo?
He's usually talking about all of us.
But what he is celebrating...
Stephen Wright, I think.
What he is celebrating is the importance of singling out from the masses, the sameness of the women and men, growing up, dying, can't even tell the difference in the next generation. Reminds me of the song about little children in ticky-tacky houses. How does it sound? Little boxes made of ticky-tacky. That song has the same kind of message.
I don't even find him so hard on that. He is making that statement that there's a sameness in all these patterns, and that you stand out when you have these qualities of love for one another. But he's not really coming down hard on all this. It's an evolutionary, inevitable, ongoing process that the world goes through.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I think he's praising the anyone's and no one's in contrast to the others. I think you're right, he's not really condemning it. He's saying this is the way it is. But what we should cherish is the kind of anyone and no one experience rather than the women and men experience. Because they have that kind of appropriate sharing. But you asked a question, one moment while I answer your question about both little and small in the fifth line. Women and men, both little and small, isn't that the same thing? I think what he's pointing out there is that there's a very narrow range of difference. They're almost all alike, he's saying. That these other people, the normal thing would be to say they're both little and big. Big and small. And he says they're little and small. That's one of those changes of the idiom that kind of startles us. We look at it again. And he's saying that these people aren't much different from each other. And they're small in a kind of spiritual sense.
Yeah, their personality is small.
Yeah.
Their size, their physique may be little, but their personality is small.
Yeah, that's right. You know, or even if their physique is big, spiritually is what he's really talking about here, isn't it? That these are, in a sense, spiritually small people or emotionally small, and that they're pretty much alike. There isn't much difference between them. So you're right in noticing that odd little parenthetical thing. You had a question.
I was wondering if he writes poetry exclusively, or does he have other works? I just vaguely recall seeing that name in some bookstores, and of course now I'm eager to go and mm-hmm. find out what he has there.
Well, he has written, I think, at least one play called The Enormous Room. It's a play or a short novel. But most of his work is poetry. There are some copies of it, both in the bookstore, collections of his poetry, both in the bookstore and in the library.
Probably where I saw it, and it just goes to prove that if you just study one little work, you want to go back and look some more.
Yeah, it is fun to discover a kind of a new writer and want to read on. Well, it's not quite supper time yet, but it's 5 o'clock, so I think I'd like to have us look very briefly at these other two, especially the one at the upper right. This poem by X.J. Kennedy that starts, "Nothing in heaven functions as it ought." Now, this was one of the other poems that I thought of when Leo was preaching last Saturday. And I couldn't find it either. But I tried to remember it. And I think I've got it just about exactly right. There's about half a line here that I'm not sure of. But you'll have to forgive me if my memory has missed a little of the phrasing. The poem is probably a little bit better than this, but this is close. So I'll read this one. And what I like about this is a sonnet. And the sonnets, you know, are 14-line poems, and they have certain ways of organizing themselves. And this is the kind of sonnet that has an 8-line section and then a 6-line section. And what X.J. Kennedy does here is to talk about heaven in the first 8 lines, and he talks about hell in the last 6 lines. And what he's doing is jarring our traditional images of what heaven and hell are like. And in the part where he talks about heaven, we laugh at it, at the images there, because he's letting us know that up there with all the saints is all this chaos going on. It's not beatific choirs, perfectly robed and in tune, but they're hacking and coughing and falling apart, all sorts of things. And the hell is not exactly what we really think of it, but has a different sense too. So you can read along with me. I'll read this one aloud. "Nothing in heaven functions as it ought. Peter's bifocals, blindly sat on, crack." Notice Peter's even got bifocals. "The pearly gates lurch wide with the cackle of a cock, not on hinges of gold as Milton had thought." Milton had written a poem about pearly gates. "Gangs of the slaughtered innocents keep blowing the nimbus off the venerable bead like a wild dandelion gone to seed. The beatific choir keeps breaking up, coughing. But hell, sweet hell, has no freewheeling part. None takes his time, nor ever quickens pace. Ask any there, how came you here, dear heart? He'll slowly slot a quarter in his face. The gears will whir and churn. A tear will start, imprinted with an abstract of his case." Now notice that the image of hell is of purely mechanistic place. There's no speeding up and slowing down. There's no freewheeling, freedom and spontaneity like we've got up in heaven with Peter's glasses that he sat on and gangs of little infants running around making trouble for older people like the Venerable Bede. Everything is mechanistic, and we have this horrible image of people down there being machine-like. Stick a quarter in the face and mechanism happens and a tear comes out imprinted with an abstract of his case, you know, the kind of legalistic, documented report kind of thing.
It sounds to me very much like X.J. Kennedy was taking one big horrible sweep at church dogma.
Sure, he's poking fun at least at our images. You see, what he's saying is that here we think that the heavenly thing is order and beauty and calmness, all these kinds of things that we think are in that perfect place. Everything will be just right. And he's saying, St. Peter's got bifocals and somebody sits on him. The choir is hacking and coughing and breaking up. Little gangs of infants are running around, images of dandelions going to seed and so forth. That's the kind of spontaneity and freewheelingness and differentness that he sees as being closer to what heaven and the divine is all about than this other. All the order is down there in hell. That's where the mechanisms, where people are like machines, kind of like the women and men in Cummings' poems. There's where you stick a quarter in the face of somebody and there's a little flurry of gears and a tear comes out and on it is imprinted that person's case history and what led to damnation.
That's what you might call a hell on earth.
That's right. And that's the point. The point that he's making is not necessarily a purely metaphysical one. He's saying that here on earth we've got to appreciate the freewheelingness, the oddballs, the bifocals. We've got to kind of celebrate the all of our imperfections.
The odd and the unusual.
The odd and the unusual, that's right. And there's no real virtue and blessing in mechanistic orderliness. Yeah.
What is the Venerable Bede?
Yeah, please.
He was one of the saints. He was an Englishman, I think about 600 A.D. He was an historian of the Christian church and early hymn writer and was a saint and was called Venerable. So he is the image of the pious, old, saintly person with the nimbus around the head and the little slaughtered innocents. Those are based on historical fact, too. In Italy or Switzerland, there was a whole group of children were killed during one of the religious wars. And Milton had written a poem about these slaughtered innocents in heaven. But instead of being cherubic, they're running around in gangs. Heaven wreaking havoc with the older folk, you see. So. Yeah, that's the halo. The kind of light around the head that we associate with saints.
Picturesque. You can just envision a child.
Right.
Up with that light.
Right.
Here goes.
Yeah. So Kennedy, too, is telling us we should celebrate the imperfections and the quirks and the odd things. Well, then finally, we won't discuss, but we'll end just by reading this poem by Gerard Manley Hopkins, who was a monk in England and wrote his poems almost 100 years ago. And they weren't even published for 30 years in England until 1918. He doesn't sound like a Victorian poet, but he was writing in the height of the Victorian period. And he was a magician with language in a slightly different way, but from E.E. Cummings, but similarly, he liked to put words together in highly unusual ways and in contrasting ways. And this is a poem of celebration about, again, imperfections. Any of you work with printing? That when you take, when typesetters, printers, when they used to take individual little pieces of lead to set all the type for a newspaper or anything printed. Once they'd gotten a whole page printed and it was all over with, they'd dump all the type back into a big drawer. It was all a jumble and a mess. And then you had to sort it out and put it in the little boxes letter by letter. That was called pie. Everything that's jumbled up and mixed up is pie.
So oftentimes I had the thought of having one all set up and in the case, in the frame, and dropping it.
Yeah, that's right. Then you'd have
blue.
Yeah. So this poem is simply a kind of hymn of praise for things that are imperfect, freckled, pockmarked, everything that's not neat, pure, clean. Glory be to God for dappled things, for skies of couple color as a brinded cow, for rose moles in all stipple upon trout that swim, fresh fire cold chestnut falls, finches wings, landscape plotted and pieced, fold, fallow, and plow, and all trades their gear and tackle and trim, all things counter, original, spare, strange, whatever is fickle, freckled, who knows how, with swift, slow, sweet, sour, a dazzle dim, he fathers forth, whose beauty is past change, praise him. Great song of praise about all the marvelous things of the world that are not neat and clean and orderly.